Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. This special weekend MegaCast is brought to you by Grove Collaborative and Quip. We're joined by JVL in studio and Jim Swift in studio as well. Thanks for coming in, gentlemen. I appreciate it very much. We have a lot to talk about.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, Charlie.
Okay, let's start with, we're in day two as we are taping this, day two of the impeachment hearings. Marie Yovanovitch, the star witness on Friday, and certainly seemed to live up to the billing, at least in the segment that we've already listened to. And I think this was certainly one of the highlights of the morning. Let's listen.
What effect do you think that has on other witnesses' willingness to come forward and expose wrongdoing?
Well, it's very intimidating.
It's designed to intimidate, is it not?
I mean, I can't speak to what the president is trying to do, but I think the effect is to be intimidating.
Well, I want to let you know, Ambassador, that some of us here take witness intimidation very, very seriously. Mr. Goldman.
So a couple of things about that. Number one, the president, Trump just cannot help himself, can he? He just cannot help himself from sitting there in the Oval Office and attacking the witnesses. And you could see almost in real time, well, actually in real time, Adam Schiff seems to be setting up a new article of impeachment, witness intimidation. So, gentlemen, who wants to weigh in on this?
It wasn't witness intimidation, Charlie. Marie Yovanovitch wasn't looking at Twitter, so therefore she wasn't intimidated. Tomorrow in the Federalist.
Oh, you know, you can't make this up. You know, it does strike me that, I mean, look, this is clearly the playbook that you're getting from everybody. You know, Rush Limbaugh has to attack the ambassadors as nerds. They tried to smear Vindman as a spy last week. You know, my good friend Sean Duffy. People push back on all of that. You have John Dowd. One of President Trump's former attorneys lashing out at them. So this is the playbook. We kind of know what Hannity and Laura Ingraham are going to do. But it does strike me that there are limits to the efficacy of smearing. I mean, first of all, there are just too many of them now. And by the end of this, it's like, are you going to smear them all? Number two, they're pretty impressive people. I mean, their credentials are impressive. The long years of service, they are presenting themselves pretty well. And number three, by the end of this process, most of what they say is going to be corroborated anyway. And yet this seems to be the playbook. Let's demean and attack everyone who comes out, which of course goes to this question of is the president sending out the bat signal that we need to slime every one of these people, presumably to discredit them, but also to intimidate other people from coming forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to always remember when we look at this stuff that the real audience for this is actually very small.
Yes.
If you are a highly partisan Republican, you're not going to move off of this because you know he's guilty and you know he did it, and you're supporting your guy. And so for you, it doesn't matter, you know, you're never going to be convinced of something because you're already convinced of it. You just don't care. And if you're a partisan Democrat, you've made up your mind that Trump was a bad guy a long time ago. So what we're looking at is really maybe like 15 or 20% of the electorate who are true independents or very light leaners.
You know,
if they look at it, though, I mean, this is what I – every time we get one of these hearings, I think for the most part, with a few honorable exceptions, the Democrats and Republicans on the committees make themselves look like clowns. Mm-hmm. In this case, I think they both look somewhat clownish in either side. Although I think the Democrats are doing a better job than normal. But I think the witnesses themselves look like grown-ups.
They really do.
And so if you are not really on either team, but you are paying attention, which again, now we're talking about a really small subset of that 15 or 20%, I do find it hard to believe that they will look at the witnesses themselves and not see them as the grown-ups in the room.
If in fact they're watching, you know, and you make an important point here that the reality is that We know what happened here. I mean, there is no mystery. We're not waiting for the smoking gun or the blue dress. Everybody on both sides knows exactly what happened here because most of it played out in real time. And the president isn't really, you know, pretending. So the only question is, what are we willing to accept? And, you know, Jim, you've written about this, the endlessly moving goalposts where people like Lindsey Graham, you know, at one point saying, well, if you ever prove there was really a quid pro quo, that would be a problem. And now he's like completely off base. But you're right. This is a very, very narrow audience, and both of them are playing for their bases. And it is interesting, and this is almost like a cliche now to talk about how you have the alternative realities, but everybody has their own soundbite. Everybody has their own YouTube highlight, and they play that. And it's enough to reassure each tribe that they won the day, that they really owned the other side. But I have to say that after the first 2 days, I'm continue to be surprised that the Democrats have really done better than I thought they were going to do. I think these witnesses have been rather persuasive. I thought the Marie Yovanovitch today was an incredibly sympathetic, very clear, very lucid, very succinct witness. And if people were watching her, I think they scored some points. Now the question is, how does her testimony relate to the core charge that the Democrats are making, that there was bribery, because she wasn't involved in some of that? But I do think you're getting the sense of just how sleazy and creepy this whole shadow Ukrainian diplomacy was.
Yeah, and again, when we're talking about, you know, how narrow the cast is here, also understand that the entire end result of this is going to be driven by really about 5% of the electorate, right? So I am firmly of the belief that the eventual Senate vote in this will be more driven by public opinion than people think.
Yeah.
And if it is just 52% of the public in favor of impeach and remove, you're going to get a couple Republican defectors, but it'll be very manageable. But if that number ticks up 5 points, you know, we get to 57-58% of the public in favor of impeach and remove. That's actually a sea change, which we can't quite imagine that world. And so, you know, both sides are playing to their bases, which I don't fully understand. The reason I think, and I agree with you, Charlie, that the Democrats have done a better job is because they have done a better job, I think, at reaching out towards that middle so far. And, you know, again, the idea is not that you have to get 70% of the country agreeing with, you know, on impeach and remove, because you can't get 70% of this country to agree on anything. But you move 5 more points and it's a different world. And we won't know until mid next week, when some of the rolling polls come out after this first week of public hearings, whether or not it has moved. There's been some evidence suggesting that people are hardened in, but I'm not sure I totally buy that, because for the last 4 weeks, we've seen quite a lot of evidence of movement. So, we'll know when we know.
And that's part of the beauty of the Senate, right? And you know, the three tiers of Senate classes, that some people, they're in this next tier. They have to face the voters next fall. Then there's another tier that has to face them in 4 years, and then another that face them in about 6. And the calculus for each of them changes with every single point that we get higher and higher. And that, I think, is, you know, to JVL's point, the beautiful thing about the Senate, because if this was the House, I mean, that's why the House votes in lockstep, because they have to face them
every
other fall.
And of course, the big question was whether this makes any difference whatsoever. And in the back of my mind, I've always thought that you know, televised hearings might actually break through some of the alternative reality silos a little bit. I mean, I know all the counter arguments, but on the other hand, even Fox News folks are sitting and having to watch some of this testimony. Well, they don't have to watch, but they may be seeing this. You know, Chris Wallace was on just a few minutes ago, and he says, if you're not moved by the testimony of Marie Yovanovitch, you don't have a pulse. So you are seeing that. Brett Baer tweeted out that he thought that the president's attack on her might have been a turning point in the testimony. She was already a sympathetic witness, so you might have a little bit of the breakthrough here from them. But I guess, you know, going back to her testimony, you know, I follow this pretty closely, but I am starting to get the picture of the role that Giuliani played, his sleazy, you know, counterparts in the Ukraine, who really were trying to shut down many of the anti-corruption efforts. And we are living in this sort of bizarre, you know, smoke and mirrors world where Trump world is trying to pretend that Trump was concerned about corruption, that he was actually putting pressure on Zelensky to do something about Ukrainian corruption, when in fact it was his guys who are the most corrupt actors. And it's sort of like everything's in sort of this mirror Escher world of ups and downs, and you could sense that from her testimony, how frustrating it is that she's trying to shut down the Ukrainian the corrupt oligarchs, and yet somehow they orchestrate a smear campaign to get rid of her, and it reaches to the highest levels of the U.S. government, and basically the worst actors in the world get their way and are being sponsored and protected by the President of the United States. And that's one of those, Jesus Christ, you knew it was bad, but this, you're starting to paint by, you know, putting in paint by numbers here of this, the level of sleaze that's going on.
And this is the big innovation of the Trump era, which is to import the authoritarian Soviet-style big lie into American politics, which is new. I mean, we've had people who are liars in office probably, you know, ever since George Washington stepped away from the job. So this is not to pretend that all American presidents or even any of them have been angels. But typically what happens is, you know, a president does something they shouldn't, and then they lie about not doing it. And what Trump does is lie that he's doing exactly the opposite of it. And it's a weird thing, because we've become so polarized that we have half the country who is willing to simply accept it even though they don't believe it. And that's the weirdness of what's going on. It literally is like the Vaclav Havel greengrocer story, right? Where, you know, the Trumpkin defenders are putting the greengrocers of the world unite signs in their windows, and of course they don't believe it. And they know that we know they don't believe it, and they don't care. They're just signifying that they're down with the party. And it's a very strange place, because I think it signals a sea change in our actual attitude towards authoritarian tendencies.
Okay, I'm just going to go back to bed now. That's it. I mean, we're just done. I just
that's what I do.
No,
bringing a ray of sunshine everywhere I go, Charlie.
You are right here. Like, for example, this morning, the White House sends out this readout of Trump's Zelensky call, the first one, an early one when he
was
called,
it perfect.
Well, no. See, this is the interesting.
It was more than perfect, because it had things that weren't even on the call.
Well, this is what's interesting about it. They put out the transcript of the call, or the rough transcript, what they call a quote-unquote transcript of this call, which completely contradicts the earlier readout back in April. So back in April, they put out a thing saying, yes, President Trump addressed corruption, democratic reform, and territorial integrity. And the transcript they released this morning that was supposed to be, you know, exculpatory to them, shows that earlier readout was just made up. The transcript doesn't even mention the word corruption. And yet, of course, there's Devin Nunes reading through all of that, saying, see, this completely exonerates the president. I mean, it is bizarre. I noticed the tweet this morning from the former Russian or U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, who said, ousting a U.S. ambassador to help Lev Parnas make money makes the U.S. look like any other corrupt pedestrian autocracy in the world. Got to clean this up, Pompeo. Well, as if Pompeo is good. But
I didn't realize he had such a rich sense of irony, McFaul.
Yeah, he. Well, it's, you know, and all of this does keep coming back to Russia. You know, I know we're not supposed to talk about the Russia hoax anymore. Otherwise, you know, Molly Hemingway is going to write about us. But
great, Jarrett.
It is interesting how every one of these things, the one common thread that runs through this, other than the sort of chronic corruption and willingness to lie and to gaslight us, is the fact that Vladimir Putin's agenda is advanced at almost every stage. I thought it was really interesting during the questioning that I think it was Daniel Goldman, who is the Democratic counsel, points out that you know who it was who floated the theory that it was Ukraine behind the hacking of the Russian interference, that it was the Ukraine that was doing that rather than the Russians. It was Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin, at a press conference with Viktor Orban, because everybody always has to be together, right? I mean, all the worst people in the world have to eventually align themselves with it. they float the idea that it was Ukraine, not Russia, that attacked, that intervened in the 2016 election, hoping that somebody would pick that up. And sure enough, entire Trump world has now picked up that debunked conspiracy theory. But you trace it back, and it's freaking Vladimir Putin.
Of course it is. It's so perfect. This is one of the deep insights Bill Kristol made, I don't know, 2 decades ago. Maybe he was just saying something that's conventional wisdom. But when I heard it, when he said it to me, it seemed like deep, deep sage wisdom. Was that in every era, the bad guys always find each other.
And yeah,
even,
yeah.
Even bad guys who you think their interests are totally divergent, they would, you know, like the, eventually the Sunnis and the Shias link arms, right? This is like why, you know, bin Laden was actually able to make inroads in Iraq.
Tulsi and Tucker.
Don't do that to me. You know, like the Japanese and the Nazis, right? Like eventually these guys, you know, the Iranians and the South American Sandinista types, right? There's no obvious reason any of these agents should wind up touching each other, but they're drawn to it by common enemies. And it doesn't surprise me that Russia winds up at the root of everything that's bad in American conservatism. That makes sense, actually.
Well, I'm looking forward to Laura Ingraham's show tonight, how Marie Yovanovitch screwed up Somalia. You know that somebody's out there has to push that line now, that it was George Soros, Marie Yovanovitch, and the reason that Somalia is a shithole country is because X, Y, Z, because since the Orange God King has put this out. Okay, so here's another thing that is just, I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on it, but in my newsletter, I linked to a piece that Connor Friedersdorf had in The Atlantic, where he really takes on our old friend Victor Davis Hanson, who suggests that this whole impeachment process is tantamount to an unconstitutional coup, and pointing out, are you kidding me? It's not a coup. It's actually in the Constitution. But it is amazing the number of folks on the right who have decided, who would normally, you know, posture, you know, take the posture of that they are the defenders of the Constitution and they are the originalists and this is why we want conservative judges, because they will defend the Constitution. And in the Constitution, there is explicitly the process of impeachment, and yet they have decided this is a coup. Jim Swift.
Well, you know, I mean, we all know that you can't have an impeachment within X days of an election, right? I mean, that's in the Constitution too. I mean, it is an absurd line of argument that I think you can trace its origins back to the shivving of Merrick Garland. You know, always defer to the election, because then Trump can go out and repeat, you know, umpteen mistruths or exaggerations about his Electoral College win. Because the Electoral College, that's in the Constitution, but impeachment, ugh. You know, there got to be exceptions to that. I mean, we got to put some guardrails on impeachment. Otherwise, it just, you know, things will go out of control.
Well, you know, I mean, this is, again, we've talked about this so many times. I you know, a few years ago, if you would have asked me who are some of the conservative thinkers on the right and writers on the right that I respected the most, I think Hanson might have been right up there.
Come on.
Okay. All right.
That guy's been a clown for 20 years.
Well, okay. Well, I'm late to the game. I'm late to the party. I'm willing.
Look, Victor Davis Hanson is the least serious person in all of intellectual public life.
How did I miss that?
Fool and a clown.
Okay, I agree.
He was a fool and a clown when he was cheerleading the Iraq War from his vineyard. This, I mean,
the coastal elites, though.
Yeah. No, the guy who runs a vineyard in Silicon Valley, who is very concerned about the coastal elites, is going to educate us about how the Bush freedom agenda is going to just run rampant all over the Middle East because Plutarch. And then because all he does is suck up to power, he goes and becomes an America First or Trump nationalist without ever doing at least a mea culpa. Like, boy, I have a lot to answer for. In between it.
Well,
fool.
Well, I can't really disagree with you here, because, you know, clearly. Unless he had some sort of an incident or is, you know, using certain pharmaceuticals, he's still the same person. You know, and this, reading this Friedersdorf piece, we just dismantles him about his dishonesty and his irresponsible language here. And you do wonder, I mean, how, you know, what this has done to us. And maybe it hasn't, you know, the Trump era maybe hasn't done anything to us. Maybe it's just simply exposed who we are. Okay, you guys want a palate cleanser, though? Should we do a palate cleanser?
Do it.
Okay, I know you. Everybody here is a big Jeopardy fan, right? We're all Alex Trebek fans. This is my favorite moment. Well, actually, well, there've been two really good Jeopardy moments when the contestant sort of did a shout out to Alex Trebek, which got everybody all choked up. This is not quite as, you know, this isn't as feel good, but I love it. Okay, so here it is.
Yeah.
Right.
Lawyers 800.
This lawyer's star rose while repping Stormy Daniels, but fell after he was accused of trying to extort millions from Nike in 2019. His name, quickly forgotten, obviously, Michael Avenatti. Back to you, Emma.
Okay, so here's the thing. Nobody knew Michael Avenatti. You know, sic transit Gloria Mundi, right, guys? Isn't this a reminder, though, of how consumable celebrity is these days, that you can be incredibly famous and a couple months later, nobody on Jeopardy knows who the hell you are.
You know, or this is a sign of how tiny internet famous still is. And because Michael Avenatti is an internet famous guy, a Twitter famous guy who also did cable news, but never really broke into mainstream American culture.
You have to stay on cable for a while before people really start recognizing.
Well, no, you have to migrate out of cable and onto like Dancing with the Stars, right? And I actually wonder if that's what this is a sign of.
Okay,
well, we who are high volume, high information news consumers, Michael Avenatti is seared into our collective memory. But out there among the people, or at least the people who can, you know, are the nerds on the Tournament of Champions, he barely registered.
Okay, but six...
I find that in a weird way comforting.
Okay, but 9 months from now, or maybe a year from now, they're going to be asking, he was the former press secretary for the President of the United States who went on to Dancing with the Stars. His name is anybody going to remember Sean Spicer?
Yeah, because he was Saturday Night. They won't remember Stephanie Grisham, but they'll remember Sean Spicer, not only because of Dancing with the Stars, but because of Saturday Night Live.
Okay, so who was Monica Lewinsky's lawyer? What was his name?
Monica Lewinsky's lawyer?
Yeah.
I was in sixth grade.
Full Ginsburg. Do you remember? It was Full Ginsburg. He became famous because
he went on every
single Sunday morning show. And of course, I'm asking you this, but I forget what his first name was. But he was
Harold.
Famous. Big time.
See, I remember Linda Tripp, but not Lewinsky's lawyer. But probably because John Goodman played Linda Tripp on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, it's okay. But come on, we got that. Now people are screaming at us, listening to this podcast, going, you know, I remember when he was, you know, Tom Brokaw was taking him to Knicks games and everything. If you look up the term Full Ginsburg, is actually in Wikipedia. William Ginsburg.
Ah, William, not Harold.
Is it William Ginsburg or William Ginsburg, attorney for Monica Lewinsky, and the Full Ginsburg he made it, and of course now nobody remembers who he is. I just think this is one of those things that the people who are very, very prominent need to remember. I mean, I always find it interesting, you know, when you go back and you read about, you know, history of the 1920s, people who are huge celebrities or huge political players who nobody has any idea who they are. And I think if you're a United States senator, or you're, you know, a cable talking head, you have to realize that this fame is fleeting. That no matter how big you are,
when we say history will remember what you do, are you saying that maybe history won't?
Well,
or only the nerds in the Tournament of Champions will or won't?
Well, it's easy to be forgotten. People remember who Margaret Chase Smith is. I don't think they're going to remember who Elise Stefanik is.
You know, I actually last night attended a lecture by a nun friend of mine, Sister Teresa, and it was all about memento mori, about remember your death. And this was a big part of it. I actually agree with Sister Teresa that almost the entire world would be better off if every one of us approached every sort of large decision we have to make. Like, okay, so how would I make this decision if I was on my deathbed?
Oh, yeah, that's Viktor Frankl. That was, yeah. Go ahead.
Memento mori.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say.
Well, okay, it's interesting you would say that because I was really get stuck by the thinking about William Barr when he's asked about, well, aren't you concerned about your legacy? And his answer was, well, I'm going to be dead soon, so I don't worry about that. It's like, wait, isn't that exactly the opposite? Is that as you are nearing death, isn't that when you ought to be considered thinking about your legacy, looking back from your deathbed? What was the meaning of my life? How am I going to be remembered? Wouldn't you think that? But apparently not.
A poorly formed human being, yes.
Okay, so I have two other issues that I want to talk about. We got to talk about Stephen Miller, and I want to talk about JVL. I want to talk about your piece breaking down about Deval Patrick, which has the headline, The Case for Deval Patrick, which is not really the case for Deval Patrick.
It's the best case I could make for him.
Okay, let's talk about this after hearing a word from our sponsors. Did you know that 70% of people say they want to use natural products, but only 2% do? That's why Grove Collaborative makes finding healthy, affordable, effective products easy and convenient. And now, more than 500,000 American households shop Grove for their healthy home essentials. Grove Collaborative is the online marketplace that delivers all natural home, beauty, and personal products directly to you. They take the guesswork out of going green. Every Grove product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. My first box arrived, and it had just an incredible array of products that my wife and I are going to be trying out. I mean, it is an amazing smorgasbord of choices. Then they deliver all of your home essentials right to your front door, and they have this huge selection of sustainable plant-based products, including all the big brands that I love and I trust, like Mrs. Meyers and Method. Everything they carry is safer for you, better for the planet, and it really works. In place of the harsh chemicals, they use natural ingredients that smell fresh and leave your house sparkling. Look, we're all busy. I certainly am. And I know that I don't have time to waste buying detergent and toilet paper, and neither do you. So give it a try and get some me time back in your day. Because with Grove, you don't have to shop multiple stores or search endlessly online to get all the natural goods you need for you and your family. They have everything that I need in one place, which... I don't want to spend a lot of time doing this, but I want to get quality stuff. So, and they have the best selection of natural home and personal care products. Things for the house, my grandkids, my dog, even some fun personal things for me. So join more than 500,000 families who trust Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier. Plus, the shipping is fast and free on your first order. For a limited time, when listeners go to grove.co/bulwark, you'll get a free 5-piece gift set from Mrs. Meyers and festive holiday scents like peppermint or Iowa pine. So go to grove.co/bulwark to get this exclusive holiday offer. That's grove.co/bulwark. Today's episode is brought to you by Quip, makers of the Quip electric toothbrush. This is something I actually have. I've been using it for months now, and they want you to know that the one single discovery that matters most for your dental care is simply this. If you have good habits, you're good. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day and flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. But Quip makes that simple. Starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulses to guide a full and even clean. And the Quip floss dispenser comes with pre-marked string to help you use just enough. Plus, Quip delivers fresh brush heads, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. You never run out. You don't have to run to the store. It comes right to you. Join more than 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. And if you go to getquip.com/sykes, that's S-Y-K-E-S, right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/sykes, S-Y-K-E-S. Let me spell that out. GETQUIP.com/sykes. Quip, the good habits company. Okay, we are back on this weekend megacast with Jonathan V. Last and Jim Swift. So first of all, one of those stories that's kind of gotten shoved aside because there's so much else that's going on here is Stephen Miller, who is the White House aide who runs everything involving immigration, And there's a big story out this week with emails suggesting that he had heavily trafficked in white nationalism, promoted racist sites. And we're talking about the fruitier ones. We're talking about places like V-Dare and American Renaissance, urging people to read Camp of the Saints, which is pretty rancidly racist. And he was writing this all to folks at Breitbart, pushing his anti-immigration agenda. This was all leaked by Katie McHugh, who we've talked about before on this podcast, somebody who had worked at a number of right-wing sites, including Breitbart, eventually got fired because she was too racist even for Breitbart, which is saying a lot. She apparently leaked this to the Southern Policy Law Center. It's out there, and yet there doesn't seem to be a lot of traction for the story that the right-hand man, the guy who's whispering about shithole countries and immigrant crimes and Mexican rapists into the ear of the president of the United States, is himself, I would say, pretty clearly white nationalist adjacent at best.
Which shocked me about this, Charlie, and I worked on the Hill the same time Stephen Miller did. I met him, and he's a jerk, just as you'd imagine. The kind of remaining sane people on the right in the punditry class who aren't never Trumpers but aren't anti Trumpers. I don't want to name names, but there's just the cognitive dissonance of, well, because the Southern Poverty Law Center was repeating this and they've made mistakes in the past and they're bad, you know, I'm going to need third party verification of these emails. I mean, Katie McHugh, we had Rosie Gray on the podcast to talk about her story, about her transformation. And, you know, considering the source as a logical fallacy and just embracing that because of some hatred of the SPLC. Look, I don't like the SPLC, but I don't understand why people refuse to make this, at least on the right. I mean, we should even if you can excuse away the excesses and horrors of Trumpism and not be full never Trump, you should not want this guy anywhere near any policymaking apparatus. And the interesting thing that I think also didn't get a lot of attention from this SPLC story was he was helping dictate the editorial message and vision of Breitbart while he was a U.S. Senate staffer for Jeff Sessions from his U.S. Senate email address. And Jeff Sessions wants to go back to the Senate. And I don't think this will change anything at the White House.
No.
Because it never will. But if it can keep Jeff Sessions out of this, you know, I personally don't like Jeff Sessions very much. But he should be asked about this if he wants his old seat back. Did you know that one of your chief policy guys was using a .gov email address to send white nationalist websites to journalists?
You presume that would actually hurt him in a Republican primary in Alabama. I agree with you completely about the fact that the source is not that relevant. However, I just parenthetically do wonder why Katie McHugh chose to leak these emails to the SPLC. Is that who it is? Southern Poverty Law.
Yeah, Southern Poverty Law. Katie, if you're listening, leak them to me too.
Well,
are happy to pour through them too.
As opposed to any other media outlet that I think would have been more than receptive to seeing this, even given how prominent Miller is. But JVL, so is Stephen Miller going to survive this?
Of course he will.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the type of you remember the weirdness. Jim, who was the guy who got fired because of the really bad Bloomberg Law unfair hit piece?
Oh, yeah.
So the guy at the Department of Transportation. I forget his name, but
Labor, right.
I mean, I'm mixing up my Elaine Chao agencies.
People, you know, like, people get fired for much less than this.
Oh, absolutely.
It is only, weirdly enough, you get more immunity the higher you get in Trump world, when it should be the opposite.
Ooh,
right?
That's
good.
Be that
the higher you go, the more damaging it is to Trump to have somebody like you next to him. But in fact, it becomes the opposite, because for Trump to fire him makes it look like it was Trump's mistake for hiring him. And so it's a sign of weakness.
Well, and
he's insulated.
And also, frankly, Donald Trump has channeled so much of Stephen Miller's rhetoric and attitude. So it's very hard for him to distance himself from Miller at this point. The other thing I think that's a little bit ironic is that nobody's really shocked by this because everybody kind of knew who Stephen Miller was. There were a lot of people in the media who for years had gotten these kinds of emails from Stephen Miller. And so, you know, all they had to do is go back into their own inboxes and go, well, yeah, we should have seen this for a long time. But I guess it's almost this despairing shrug that, yes, you have this white nationalist clearly, we're not talking. I am aware of the danger of crying wolf when it comes to racism, but he's way past the line. Okay, so
he's not the only one though. No, Julia Hahn from Breitbart, yeah,
but he's the Rasputin. He's the guy with the ideas and the agenda. Okay, so let's talk about Deval Patrick, the latest white knight entry. By the way, that's your term, JVO, to refer to Deval Patrick, the white knight entry into the race. Obviously, there's, you know, in the among the Democrats, there's real Elizabeth Warren panic that she cannot win, and there's real concern that Joe Biden can't go the distance. By the way, there's a new poll out. I think I saw Reuters Ipsos that would show that Warren's momentum seems to have just completely evaporated. So we'll see where this goes. So you get Bloomberg, who is floating the idea of running. I don't know if you guys saw. He's now saying he's going to spend $100 million on anti-Trump ads. So
no matter what.
Yeah.
Well,
so
that's good.
So for people who are saying,
you got to add a couple zeros to that.
So I can do both things. I can run and I can run $100 million. But Deval Patrick, certainly on paper, is more interesting. I mean, he is an African-American, successful governor of Massachusetts, very close to Barack Obama, beloved by Obama world, perhaps even the anointed one. JVL, you write that you think that if he would have run back in 2016, he might have been elected president.
Yeah, I think if he had run in 2016, he would have beaten Hillary Clinton pretty decisively. Yeah, I mean, don't forget, she did lose half of the votes to Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. who is not even a Democrat, right? So she was much weaker than anybody understood at the time. And if he had jumped into this race in a normal fashion, I think we would have considered him, at least at the outset, among the top tier. We would have looked at him, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren as the real heavyweights in the race until Biden then got in. But waiting as he did, I just don't understand. I don't understand his move to get in as anything other than a sign that people in the Democratic establishment simply refuse to believe that Biden is real and that they believe Biden's hold on African-American voters is more tenuous than it looks. That's the only reason I can understand about this, because Deval Patrick has literally nothing going for him in this moment except the idea that because he's black and because he's very good friends with Barack Obama, that he is going to march into South Carolina and take over and win it, which he has to do. In order to have any path at all to the nomination, he has to win South Carolina somehow.
Okay.
Again, I like him a lot, but he went to the Milton Academy, Harvard undergrad, Harvard Law. He is the former governor of Massachusetts and most recently worked at Bain Capital. Why is it people think that he is going to march into South Carolina and all of a sudden take over for Joe Biden with African-American voters who have known Biden for, you know, 20 years and like him a lot?
Okay, so I don't know if you have your piece in front of you. The five possible scenarios in descending order of probability?
I don't have it, so you'll have to prompt me.
Okay.
I think the most likely one is the Rick Perry / Fred Thompson
okay.
scenario.
All right, so let's start the descending order. The number one, he flashes and fades quickly. Fred Thompson, Rick Perry, one of the latest candidate who just looks great on paper, falls flat on their face when they get in the race. Number two, he siphons off enough voters in New Hampshire to either ruin some other candidate's day or render the results such a muddle that there's no clear winner and any momentum from Iowa is blunted in the Granite State. So he messes the race up would be number two, right?
Yeah, I think so, because you can imagine we now have three favorite sons running in the vicinity of New Hampshire. And so what happens if Pete Buttigieg either wins or finishes second in Iowa and then marches into North Carolina and finishes fourth marches into New Hampshire and finishes either fourth or fifth instead of third or fourth, right? That sort of blunts his momentum and screws things up for him. So you could see how a Patrick, you know, getting to like 12%, just enough to push somebody else further down in the pack, could really hurt them, even if his campaign was going nowhere.
And number three, and again, this descending order of probability, builds enough support to actually do well in South Carolina. So that would really screw things up. Probably means you're going to go into the convention with a floor fight.
I think so, right? So again, as you sort of look, if that were to happen, it would mean then that we have a three-way split and not a two-way split of the Democratic electorate. Right now, we have sort of working class whites and older Democrats split off with Biden, and young progressives and liberals with Warren / Sanders. And then we have African-American voters mostly with Biden. If Patrick were to come in and split off African-American voters but not take the white working class and older Democrats with him, then I don't know that any one candidate is going to be able to get to the majority of delegates needed to capture the nomination before you get to the convention.
That'd be a lot of fun here in Milwaukee. And the least likely, of course, he does so well in the debates that he becomes the VP nominee. And the least likely is he catches fire in New Hampshire, consolidates African Americans, wins in South Carolina, becomes the clear Goldilocks consensus choice on Super Tuesday. And when you really look at it like that, that does seem like the least likely. But I think the other point you make in this piece, though, is the reason that it's not likely that he's going to catch fire is because the race is more locked in than it looks, because there's no obvious hole in the race. I mean, if you want a lefty, you got a lefty, right? I mean,
two of them.
Yeah. Right. I mean, so where do you fit in? I mean, if there are moderates in the race. There are other, what is the case for Deval Patrick over Cory Booker at the moment?
Right. I mean, the case is heir to Obama, but we have the heir to Obama in the race as well. In fact, we got the guy who was Obama's business partner. And Deval Patrick's line is going to be, well, I was a client of David Axelrod, too, and I'm Barack's best friend in real life. And I just don't know, while you're trying to introduce yourself to voters, because he has no national profile. Yeah. I mean, people out there in America don't know who he is. Only people who are, again, high-information political junkies do. And did you watch his video?
I did.
His intro video, what did you make of it?
I thought it was pretty content-free. I thought it was interesting, but it certainly didn't make a compelling case that he'd really thought this thing out.
And did you hear anything in that was different from anything that every presidential candidate says?
No, I think that what he was basically saying was he's going for the, hey, could I be the candidate of the coalition of the decent? But I'm not sure that's compelling enough for the Democratic field to push the existing candidates aside.
Right. And why wouldn't that be Cory Booker, right? Cory Booker's a decent guy who everybody likes, right? I mean, this is what I'm saying. Like, there is no edge. He does not seem to have an idea. He seems more like an insurance policy or a hedge.
Yeah.
I guess.
What
happens if Biden's eye blows up in the middle of a debate where he can't remember Obama's name, and then he gropes Amy Klobuchar?
Yeah.
Right. So if that all happens, and then voters recoil from Medicare for All, and people then freak out about Pete Buttigieg being gay and 37 years old, then Deval Patrick is there.
I think that's exactly the thinking. I mean, really, you've kind of run through what's going on as Democrats are lying awake at night thinking, oh, my God, what could possibly go wrong?
And, you know, to be honest, that's better than having Mike Bloomberg there as your fallback option, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe. No.
Okay, one last topic before we go into the weekend here, because it's very, very rare that we can actually find somebody who's a Cleveland Browns fan. I'm sorry. Mm. It's just, but Mr. Swift, who?
Yes.
Long suffering. So Thursday night, Browns finally do something that is very unusual for them. They win a game.
And convincingly, too.
They won the game. They beat the Pittsburgh Steelers. And then, of course, you have Myles Garrett, who rips off the helmet of the Steeler quarterback and then swings his own helmet at him. I mean, it's one of the most bizarre things. He's done, right? I mean, Myles Garrett is done for this.
And Charlie, as we spend many hours in this podcast studio talking about guardrails and norms, as a Cleveland Browns fan, I think he should be done for the year. I was with him up until he swung the helmet. You know, I'm going to talk about this in my newsletter today. You can go frame by frame in the 4K ultra HD slow-mo, like this is, you know, the Zapruder film. And you will see that Rudolph, after he'd been sacked on two consecutive plays, and Garrett got him right after he got the pass off and wrestled him to the ground, probably would have been a penalty.
Okay, gentlemen, we don't have a sound. We don't have a sounder here for breaking news.
Oh, Roger Stone.
Roger Stone, guilty.
Guilty on, according to at least four counts.
Yeah. What a surprise! It's just, I actually did like JVL. I really did like Molly Jung Fass piece the other day where she pointed out that Roger Stone had been skating for years because he thought he was too powerful to be held accountable, and the fact was he was considered too much of a joke ever to really be taken seriously. And then suddenly when he is taken seriously and charged, he finds he's not in fact powerful enough to avoid being held accountable. So this Roger Stone story also seems to be an incredibly undercovered story, right? I mean, there is...
Yeah,
there
it's
is,
happening in impeachment, right? It's get over... Everything gets plowed under by impeachment.
But also, this is the... And I'm a little bit puzzled by the way that Mueller handled this, because this is the story of Roger Stone, you know, and it is the link between the Trump campaign, WikiLeaks, the Russian hacking. There's a direct line. The prosecutors specifically say that Roger Stone was lying because he wanted to protect Donald Trump. I mean, it's really, it is sort of like the Mueller report, the whole Russia thing, sort of rising from the grave after everybody thought it was all over. And there's Roger freaking Stone, who finally is going to go to jail.
Guilty on all seven counts.
Wow.
According to Darren Samuelson from Politico. The judge tells Stone and his lawyers to take a seat, thanks the jury, and says the jury is free to discuss this case.
Really?
So we are going to have a lot of HLN late night specials but if we think that this has been undercovered, I think that that's about to change.
Okay, so JVL, how many times have we said this though? You know, Donald Trump's having a lousy day. He's tweeting out, by the way, stock market up big, new and historic record, jobs, exclamation point. But it's not. But how many bad days has he had?
All of them. Right. I mean, this is all he has are bad days, and all he will have from here to the horizon are bad days. There is no good news just waiting to pop up from underneath the surface for him. I'm interested about the pardon and about whether or not Stone has to sit in jail for a year and wait for his pardon, or if Trump gets him out now as a signal to other people in impeachment. Because this is why, right? If he doesn't pardon Stone now but tells him, just sit and cool your heels, I'll get to you, then you run the risk of having somebody else in one of the other cases against him thinking that he isn't going to watch their back, and so they've got a flip on him. And
yeah, but if,
so he
but
may
if,
need to.
But if he did that, that's one of those events that I can see really changing the dynamic of impeachment. If he actually starts handing out, pardons in order to either, you know, to influence witnesses. I mean, that seems to be clearly impeachable. Even Democrats, I'm sorry, even Republicans might, but hey, what am I saying?
No.
What am
no.
I? I'm sorry.
Well, he won't just quietly do the pardons. He'll talk about it at these rallies. And that's where I think you're right, Charlie, that a potential for a Stone or other pardons really can impact impeachment, at least the persuadables, if he starts just doing these riffs about why Roger Stone's such a great guy.
Well, you know,
yeah, right, which he could do, and how unfairly Roger Stone was treated, and he'll be looking at that.
Well, you know, and this is the point that Benjamin Wittes made over at Lawfare, and I wrote for the Bulwark. If you read between the lines, you read that volume two of the Mueller report. I think it makes the case that Donald Trump not only obstructed justice, but that he successfully obstructed justice, that he successfully intimidated enough witnesses, you know, dangled the pardons openly enough that, in fact, there were people who refused to cooperate, who, you know, in the face of Paul Manafort, is still sitting in jail and probably will be pardoned after if Donald Trump is defeated, or after the election, either way, after the election. So, yeah, this is something to watch here. But Roger Stone, that's a hell of a day. So As we finish up this podcast, we have the very compelling testimony from Marie Yovanovitch on day two, the president tweeting an attack on her, which Adam Schiff seems to be interpreting as overt witness intimidation, and the conviction on all counts of Roger Stone. Wow. So happy weekend, gentlemen.
Yeah. No one's happier than Miles Garrett.
I don't know about that. Why? Why's
my... Well, it's changing the news cycle.
Yeah, but he's going to be sitting at home for a very, very long time.
Yeah, a lot to watch.
All right. Thanks for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by Grove Collaborative and Quip. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.